Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to have on the program today Swoosie Kurtz. Hello.
Oh, Vic, you pronounced my name right. Thank you so much. It's so rare.
It rhymes with Lucy, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
It's not woozy.
Well, you know, I learned that because I read your new memoir.
You did.
I did.
The whole thing?
I read every word. I even read the footnotes and this extensive CV you have at the end.
Oh, yes. And yes. The index? Did you get to the index?
I read the index. I read it all.
You're a brave man.
Yeah, well, you know, it was really fun. And I really enjoyed finding out all this stuff. The book is called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. And the title alludes to your rather unusual name.
Correct. I was named after a B-17 airplane that my father flew in the war. He was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II, and he flew a plane during his career called the Swoose, which was a combination of old parts and new parts. And there was a song out at the time called Half Swan, Half Goose. Alexander is a Swoose, something about this strange-looking bird. So they named it that. And I was named after the airplane.
And this airplane was a pretty amazing airplane.
Yes. There were books written about it. It was quite a survivor. It was the only B-17 to survive the Philippine and Java wars, that theater over there. And it was in the Smithsonian for years and years. And now it's being, this is exciting, it's being renovated by the Air Force Museum, the Museum of Aviation. So it will pretty soon be on display with the Memphis Belle, which they're also restoring.
Is that at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
Yes, it is, exactly.
Well, we're about 10 miles away from there.
Oh, forgot. Of course you are.
I'll have to go see it.
Yes. I mean, it's such a long process, the restoration. It takes so much money and all of that. But it's in progress, which is very exciting. So.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about some of the stuff in this book. This is a story about you, about your life, but it's really a story about your family. You were an only child, mm-hmm. and your parents are so much a part of this story.
They are. It's really a Valentine to my parents who gave me the world. They instilled in me this sense of self-esteem and confidence and steadfast belief in myself that really I carry through each day, and it's a huge part of who I am today. And they were the two most extraordinary people I know, and really two icons of the greatest generation. My mother, you know, my mother and I especially have always been joined at the heart. She lives with me, my choice. She's 98 and a half. I love to call her my 98 and a half-year-old toddler.
Hmm.
And what I really wanted to write about, Vic, was not so much a celebrity memoir of, oh, I did this and this and something funny happened backstage or on the set. I mean, there's certainly that in the book, but the story I really wanted to tell was about them and the impact they've had on my life and the... Most especially these last 7 years, this journey I've been on with my mom, of so many, you know, of us baby boomers are experiencing this now, and I feel that part of the story is especially something so many people out there, so many readers can identify with. And really, it's the part of the story that I'm most proud of, because she, you know, started to show signs of declining about 7 years ago, and she's always been my rock, my confidant, my best pal. And you kind of don't know what's happening, and you're not prepared for it. And then the tables turn, and you're the head of the family. And all of these decisions are up to you about someone else's life. And I've ended up parenting my own mother.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, so many people out there are facing this now. So it's been and continues to be an amazing journey. I like to call her my 98-year-old toddler because I never had children, which was also a choice I made, but I'm not getting out of this world without being a nurturer because she's brought out in me a quality I never thought I had, which was nurturing and a maternal thing that I never thought was there in myself.
Swissy Kurtz joins us. We're talking about her memoir, Part Swan, Part Goose, and you begin each chapter with an excerpt from a book that your mother wrote, her own memoir that she published back in 1945 called My Rival, the Sky. And it's so wonderful to hear her voice and to hear what she's thinking about. And then you have these extraordinary photos. So many of these photos just touched my heart of your parents together.
Oh, yes. There's, you know, my father taught her to fly. And there's that photo of her in the book with on the wing of a plane, the two of them. And she has on a flying suit that was the smallest flying suit they could find for her. But, of course, it's just billowing out. And the great thing is that on her little feet are these spectator pumps.
I love those shoes.
I love it.
They really catch your eye when you look at the photo. You go,
yes.
What is she wearing?
I don't know. Just those little pumps. She always had great shoes, you know. But they really were an amazing kind of movie star couple, you know, as you can see from the cover. And you know, I just told her that the first, you know, she thanks me all the time for doing all of this for her, and because she's still pretty much here. Sometimes, you know, there's a certain amount of kind of pleasant dementia, and sometimes not so pleasant. It's a constant navigation and a challenge, you know, exhilarating and exhausting. And people tell me, just remember, Swoos, it's a roller coaster ride, but you're not on it. Mm. And well, you know, that's easy to say, but I kind of am. Because when you see the person you love most in the world in pain and lost or bewildered, inconsolable, you want to help them. You know, you want to make it all better. And I've learned this, that one of the many things I've learned is I can't necessarily make it better. I can't fix everything. I can only do what I can do for her in the moment. And she constantly said her mantra is, I don't want to be in the way. I don't want to be in the way. Mm. And I say to her, Mommy, you're not in the way. You are the way.
Oh, my. Well, you've developed this technique of talking to her and being in the moment with her. And people like to say, you know, be here now, be in this moment right now. And you couldn't be more in the moment than you are with her, because she'll have a suggestion or an idea, and it might not be actually something that's real, but you go along with it.
Yes, I have these incredible caregivers who are with her day and night, and I'm so blessed to have them. And I realize not everyone has the resources to do that, and I feel so grateful and so in awe of people who have to do it themselves, because that's how I started out, doing it all by myself. And oh boy. But we do a lot of improvising. We have our own little sort of acting troupe, our own little second city here, because she'll come up with things of thinking her parents are going to arrive tonight, you know, Gigi and Daddy Art. And she said, are they coming tonight? And we used to do reality checks. We used to do a few years ago, we go, Mommy, Gigi and Daddy Art died, you know, many, many years ago, or her sister Mickey. You know, Mickey died a few years. Now we don't do that. We go, Mickey's in Laguna Beach, and Gigi and Daddy Art are in Omaha.
Uh-huh.
You know, and even my dad, she'll say, is Frank's coming tonight, right? And we'll say, well, he's in Washington, D.C. on a mission for the Pentagon right now. And every time it's fresh, you know, it's always the first time.
You mentioned in the book that when your dad died, there was a memoir in the New York Times, and I went back and I dug out the memoir or the obit, and I this guy who wrote it, he was the best obit writer they ever had at the New York Times.
Oh, the best. Robert McGee Thomas, just amazing.
And I, when I read this, I said, what an incredible man. What an incredible story. I've had John Glenn on the program, and I always have considered him to be the luckiest man that ever lived. But I think your dad's competitive.
Very competitive. Yeah.
I guess we probably have some listeners out there who are saying, come on, Swissy Kurtz is famous for being an actress, and you're not talking about any of her stuff. So I guess we better talk about the fact that you're the hardest working person in Hollywood.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope to keep that illusion going. I'm still on the train. That's all I know. And, you know, you're usually euthanized after age 40 in Hollywood, or maybe 35. So I really feel grateful and lucky. I mean, especially to have gotten a gig like Mike and Molly. I mean, this is just the gift that keeps on giving.
And I did go back, as you suggested. You suggested that I should go on YouTube and look up that program that you were on with Mary Tyler Moore, and I did. And that was tough.
You know, we had a great time, but, I mean, how can you not have a great time when the cast is, you know, it was like a Saturday Night Live situation. It was sketches and music. Well, we did musical numbers. Can you believe David Letterman, Michael Keaton, Dick Shawn, Mary, and me? I mean, to see Letterman, you know, trying to do choreography, to follow this choreography to this song, you know, the Beatles song With a Little Luck,
mm-hmm.
was just priceless. It's an image I'll never forget.
Swoosie, you got the acting bug so early, and once it bit, it never let go. When I saw that when you were in high school at Hollywood High, you actually did a little cameo on the Donna Reed Show, I was astonished.
Mm-hmm. I did.
And you just kept on going, but you give us lots of detail about a lot of other things that you were involved with. Like, you didn't make it to Woodstock, but somehow your eyeball got on stage with Jimi Hendrix.
Exactly. I was, my boyfriend at the time, my quite a long time boyfriend, was Joshua White, who created the Joshua Light Show. And those of your listeners out there over 40
uh-huh.
may remember this, at the Fillmore East in New York. And it was this big place where every weekend they would have, you know, the Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Jefferson Airplane, all these, Janis Joplin, all these amazing people. And he did the light show. He was up in the projection booth dropping these liquids onto glass, and it would be projected on the screen behind the performers on stage. And everyone, of course, was on acid or marijuana or something, you know, except Josh and me, who were totally straight.
Uh-huh.
And he did this photo shoot of my eyeball, of close-ups of my eyeball, and he projected my eyeball on screen with Jimi Hendrix performing live in front of it. So I can actually say I was on stage with Jimi Hendrix, or at least my eyeball.
I think one of the more amazing things that you talk about in the memoir is the project you worked on in 1984 with Michael Bennett.
Oh, yes. Scandal, which was to be Michael Bennett's next Broadway musical after, you know, Chorus Line, Dreamgirls, Ballroom. We all know Michael was this amazing genius. And I spent a year on that project in rehearsal room with Michael Bennett, which is something that I will never forget. And we did four workshops in very much the same way that he developed Chorus Line. Jimmy Webb was writing the music, and Treva Silverman, who did the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the original one, was writing the book. And we were all set to go to Broadway after a year and actually open the show. Nobody had seen it except the in people, in, you know, like in Michael's life. And it was very suddenly and brutally postponed indefinitely were the words.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually came out that Michael had developed AIDS. And it was a musical about my character, who was the lead, was this woman who wanted to be more sophisticated sexually. And, you know, her husband had left her, and she felt that she needed to travel the world and find out more and develop her sense of sexuality. And you know, the feeling at the time was that Michael felt this was that he had AIDS now was not compatible with the spirit of this show, which was about sexual adventures and development, you know. So, but it was a great year. Singing and dancing with the best dancers in New York. You know, because I'm not a singer-dancer. I'm an actor. So it was heaven. It was heaven, and then it was heartbreak.
And what could have been and never was. And yet, when you get a feeling of devastation when something like that happens, you just pick it up and move on, don't you?
You try. I mean, I didn't at first, certainly. It was like a grieving period, you know, something that had been so huge a part of my life and was going, just had the potential of such great promise. I mean, a real life changer, a career changer, and have that just all be, whoops, it's gone, was a big hole in my life and my heart. But, you know, that's show business. I mean, that can happen at any minute.
Mm-hmm.
Things are so perilous, as they are in life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We never know. So that was an amazing year of my life with Michael Bennett.
Swissy Kurtz joins us. Her memoir, Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. She joins us by telephone on the program today. We finally tracked her down.
I was MIA.
Well, it was certainly worth it. And I think one of my favorite photos in the book is a picture of your grandparents in Omaha.
Oh, yes.
I love that.
I finally realized at about age 35 that my grandparents were named Art and Grace. And it just suddenly hit me, isn't that beautiful? They were two solid pioneer Omahans who were just made of the greatest grit ever. You know, my grandmother homesteaded in South Dakota. My grandfather was a cattleman. And they pretty much raised me when I was very small, because my parents, I always like to say they abandoned me. And the scars are still there, you know. They abandoned me with great love to my incredible grandparents in Omaha. And so I lived with them for quite a while during those first, you know, two or three years probably, while my dad and mom were off on war bond tours.
And then you finally got a base there in California where you were able to return to their house for many years to come.
Mm-hmm.
And that became your base. And you've described this book as a Valentine to your parents, but you include a few warts. It's not all beautiful. There are things when your dad starts going into decline, there are some pretty, mm-hmm. pretty tough things in here.
Very tough. Very tough. There's definitely some ugly in there. And that's what I mean by the you know, the right choices that empowered me and the wrong choices that I learned so much from, and parts of my life that I, you know, in looking back now and inventorying, I didn't handle well, and that was probably the biggest, was like the last year of my father's life. I was, you know, working 17-hour days on sisters and very, very, you know, stressed, and in a good way. I love that, and I love working. But when he started to decline, and we were all living in this very, very tiny house, you know, filled with love, but I didn't have the patience or the compassion that I would have now when things started to happen. And I was, you know, focused on my work, and I had to learn my lines, and I had to get my sleep, and these things were happening, and I reached my limit and got to the tipping point where I had to kind of say an ultimatum, you know, like it's him or me. I mean, so, and I say in the book, like, people go, I can hear the readers going, why didn't she get her own house, for God's sake? Sort of never occurred to me. But eventually I did. But with television, you never know. You think, oh, well, this job will only last a few more episodes or whatever. And, you know, 6 years later, Sisters, you know, we did 125 episodes, so who knew? But, yeah, and no, it's places that you really don't want to go back to. When I started writing about those times in my life, certain things you don't want to go to. I mean, writing an autobiography like this is a sort of intense form of self-analysis. And you go, okay, now what about this section of your life? In, you know, the other Swoosie goes, oh, I don't really want to talk about that right now. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the happy time when I was, you know, did this so well and I was celebrated for that. And then the editor Swoosie goes, no, we really have to cover this now. That, I think, was one of the most painful chapters, was about my father's decline, which is something I also think, you know, baby boomers readers can relate to so well. And I mean, that's one reason about this book that I felt I wanted to share with people, this journey with that I was on with my dad and to a greater extent with my mom the last 7 years. So that, you know, that hopefully it will make people laugh and cry, and you know, if someone out there or someone they love is caring for an aging parent, that this story will hopefully make them feel not so alone. Because you do feel alone and isolated when this is happening.
So how did this project evolve? How did it actually come to fruition?
Well, the dream began when we went to war with Iraq, and I reread my mother's book that she wrote when she was pregnant with me. And I went, you know, this book could have been written yesterday, except for the fact that then they didn't have cell phones and texting and Skyping and all this. They had no communication except for that. You know, people don't change. Someone goes off to war, it's the same feelings, the same dynamics, the same emotions. And I thought, I have got to get this book re-released for a brand new generation. And that was my dream, and with an introduction by me. And now that's happened. It's being released at the same day my book is being released. It's being released as an e-book. So it's thrilling to me. And as you say, there are excerpts from her book in my book, because it kind of shows the parallels of the very, very different choices that my mom and I made. And yet both, you know, turned out great, but very different roads that we took.
Swoosie Kurtz joins us. Her memoir is Part Swan, Part Goose. And some of the stuff you describe in here is just so wild and crazy. Like when you were working on projects on the East Coast and the West Coast simultaneously, and you would get on a plane and fly back and forth and sleep on the plane. I mean, that's just nutso.
It was insane. And people said, you can't do that. That's impossible. How can you work a day on Sisters in Burbank and then fly to North Carolina and do this movie with Katharine Hepburn? And whenever anybody tells me something's impossible, I got to do it. You know, it's a sort of heroic call of the ego or something, like, I'll show you I can do it. It's going to kill me, but I can do it. And actually, I felt totally exhilarated doing it because it was, first of all, turned out to be the last thing that Katharine Hepburn ever did on film, and we're together in the last scene that she ever did on film. And she inspired me, because the first morning I was there, I thought, oh my God, I don't think I can do this. It's 4:30 in the morning. I can't, oh my God. And you know, I thought to myself, wait a minute, Swoos. Katharine Hepburn flew here. She got herself here. She's getting up at the same, you know, she's got to be in makeup the same time you are. She's got lines to learn. I think you can do it.
Hmm.
And just amazing, you know, working with her. I would never have that chance again. So I had to do it. I had to make it work. And the Sisters people were wonderful about organizing, you know, my shooting days so they would be compressed into, you know, a very long day here, a very long day there, so I could fly there for a day or a day and a half and shoot, then fly back. And I knew that it was finite, you know. It was for a month or so, so I could do it.
Well, that must be really something to work with someone who has had a long career like that and to be in one of their final films. I somewhere in my mind, I'm remembering a film I think you did in 1983 called A Caribbean Mystery with Helen Hayes.
Oh, my God, yes. How do you know that, Vic?
Isn't that something that I would remember that? She was
Helen
a grand dame of acting.
Oh, my God. Thrilling to work with her, too. And what a game gal she was. I mean, just up for anything. Never complained. Never, no diva. You know, well, she's from the theater, you know.
Uh-huh. And that really is your great love, isn't it? I can't believe how many plays you've been in.
I can't either. I never thought I'd get to the point in my career where I actually would forget things that I did, but I look back now, and in doing this book, I had to compile the list, you know, and I was like, oh, my God, and I did that, that. Am I 90? I felt like I was, this person has to be 90. Yeah, but the theater is certainly where I grew up and honed my craft, and it is, but I... But there's something I also love about television, the immediacy of it. I love the Mike and Molly model, the sitcom model, because it's the most like theater. You know, you rehearse and rehearse all week. You really work on the material. You don't have to worry about being costume or hair and makeup or any of that crap, you know. And you just work on the material. And I'm all about the material. That's what really turns me on and helps me make a decision as to whether I say yes or no to a project. And to just work on the material, and then one night a week we get all dressed up and we show them what we've got, the live audience. And that chemistry with the live audience is something that just is, it's addictive. And there's just nothing like it.
Well, it's an extraordinary body of work, and we're so pleased that you could spend a few moments with us on the program today.
Well, thank you so much, Vic. Thank you for reading the book and saying such nice things about it. I really appreciate it.
Our guest has been Swoosie Kurtz, and her book is Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening. Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.